Show.
Did you know that Eric wears dentures that have been in his family for generations?
It's true. They're discolored and disgusting.
But they have deep personal meaning for Eric, so we ask that you respect that.
And now your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show special July 4th week edition. We've decided to start celebrating now. Okay, now, right now. And we have Albin. Albin, you there?
I'm here. I'm ready to celebrate.
And what about our producer, Chris Himes? Is he there?
Yes. Hello, Eric. Hi. I'm driving right now. I'm behind the wheel. I'm actually doing Uber for some extra cash. I'm multitasking.
I know. That's why, you know what? Let's be honest. You guys don't get paid what you're worth.
No.
You get double what you're worth. But no, seriously, you don't get paid what you're worth. And before we get to, we've got a number of jokes, ladies and gentlemen. Don't go away. We've got a number of things. But I want to say that people have to support us by going to our sponsor, Mike Lindell, MyPillow.com. Put in Eric. Help us out so I can pay these guys. Because Chris is literally driving an Uber to make cash while he's doing the program. It affects the quality of the show. Albin,
I'm just going
to announce a couple of things real quick.
I'm selling Girl Scout cookies, just so you know.
Yes, that's what I meant to say.
That's my thing.
Because this is a special July 4th edition of the program, even though it's not even July. July is tomorrow. Today's June 30th. But we want to celebrate the week early and make a few announcements. So this is July 4th week. So if you're watching me on video, you can already see that I'm wearing a special Yankee Doodle tie and shirt combination. I don't get to wear this very often. And so I just thought I would wear it today. In a few minutes, we're going to have a dramatic reading of Yankee Doodle Muggsy. I'll explain that in just a moment, but we're going to have a dramatic reading of that following our annual reading of Yankee Doodle Muggsy, which has sound effects. Chris did an amazing job putting this together. You can see the book. It's the book I did with Tim Raglan. After that, I'm going to have a conversation with Father Frank Pavone. We're going to talk about yesterday's ruling regarding abortion and John Roberts and why he's evil. And then, hey, wait a minute. And then in hour two, this is key. We're going to have an interview with David Barton. Some of you know he's kind of America's historian. David Barton is going to be on this program, special July 4th week, as I said. And after David Barton, we're going to have more July 4th kookiness with me wearing this tie. In case you're listening on radio, it is a tie with a blue background and white stars. My shirt is red, in honor of July 4th and Independence Day. Now, Albin, we've got some jokes that we want to share, but before that, I want to share some jokes that I didn't write. Some people know this weekend was my birthday.
Yes.
And everybody knows I don't like getting birthday cards, so don't send me birthday cards. But people send me cards sometimes. If they're very close to me, I let it go. But I got a card from a friend, Paul Erickson. And honestly, this was so funny. I said, I think I have to show this on the air. I printed it out on a piece of paper, and so I can maybe hold it up to the camera here. But it's a picture of Ishmael from Moby Dick, and he's talking to someone, right? And he says, "This is." This is Captain Ahab, okay? Captain Ahab, you know, he had the famous peg leg, and the start of Moby Dick is Call Me Ishmael, and then he tells his story about Ahab and the whale and the peg leg and all that stuff. So this is the card that my friend Paul Erickson sent me. It says, really, I'm fine. You know, Ishmael always exaggerates. And when you look at it, you can see that Captain Ahab doesn't have a peg leg. He has a peg finger.
Hmm. Okay.
And I thought that was hilarious.
Hmm.
And if you don't tell me. Okay. But then I got another card from Alyssa LeBaris. You know, she is she's the queen of all media. She makes the trains run on time. She manages my life. And she sent me a card, and it says, there's a guy. It's like, looks like biblical times, right? And there's a guy, and he says, I was dead. Dead, I tell you, dead. And now I'm alive. And at the bottom, it says, Lazarus tries to explain why he was so late in sending a birthday card. Now, I got to tell you, I think that was so funny because I don't find a lot funny. Like, I'm really hard to please. And Alyssa said that she found it in the Wheaton College bookstore 15 years ago. Or, yeah, 15 years ago. And she bought 10 copies. And this was her last one. So I just wanted to say, some cards really are funny. Those two are really funny. Now, we've got some jokes. Should we save the jokes until after David Barton? I think we should save these jokes until after David Barton.
Yeah. I wanted to make a little statement here, though, because we are celebrating, in fact, this entire week, the 4th of July. And I think it's a good thing because this time next year, depending on who wins the election or not, this may not be kind of like, quote unquote, legal to celebrate this particular date, July 4th, as our.
Oh, I know, because we found out, you know, the Black Lives Matter cult, who don't really care about Black lives, the Marxist Antifa cult.
Yeah.
They have declared July 4th and Mount Rushmore to be racist. And so, yeah, next year, this time, if Trump doesn't win, it could be very dark. We could all be wearing, you know, mourning clothes. Now, let me just say that in a few minutes, all right, I want to announce this correctly. So let me do this. We'll save the jokes for after David Barton in hour two. Yeah. But these are good jokes, folks. You don't want to miss them. But in a couple of minutes, we are going to play the audio. And if you're following this on video, you'll see the video. But I've written a number of books with my friend Tim Raglan. Tim Raglan is a dear friend for 30 years. It's amazing. And he's a genius illustrator. Okay. He illustrated Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. He illustrated The Birthday ABC, which I wrote. He illustrated Yankee Doodle Muggsy. And Yankee Doodle Muggsy is a celebration of July 4th. And it's one of the favorite books that I've ever written, children's books. And so I'm going to do a dramatic reading of that in just a couple of minutes. So you want to gather the children around. If you have a copy of Yankee Doodle Muggsy, you might want to pull it out. Maybe we'll do this again tomorrow because not everybody listens every day. But it's a fun story. It's the sequel to Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas. Tim Raglan's illustration has never been more brilliant. Now, anybody who knows my Donald the Caveman series, which is really, you know, a satire for adults in the form of a kid's book, those are also illustrated by Tim, but that's his abbreviated illustration style. When you look at the Muggsy books and the Birthday ABC, I've never seen anything that I want more. His illustrations are just magnificent. Some of the most beautiful illustrations. He's won many awards. Anyway, you can look him up online, Tim Raglan, R-A-G-L-I-N, and you can get copies from him or whatever. These copies are all over the internet. But I'm going to read that in a couple of minutes. But just to explain for those people who are unfamiliar with the Muggsy saga, what's coming up, Uncle Muggsy is a bachelor bulldog. He's a bulldog, kind of like a W.C. Fields character, kind of a curmudgeon. He lives alone in a mansion with his manservant Peeves, like Jeeves. And in the first episode, Uncle Muggsy and the Terrible Twins of Christmas, which we play around Christmas time, he has an experience and he realizes he's been living selfishly. So he decides to adopt these cute little bulldog puppies who are his niece and nephew. He gets married to Miss Dogmont. So in episode two, which is not a Christmas story, it's a July 4th story, it's a similar thing, but the villain this time is not Muggsy. It is his mother-in-law who's from England. She hates July 4th. She doesn't recognize it. That for her, that was it was a terrible thing. So it's a battle for Muggsy trying to celebrate Independence Day with the two little kids. And it's funny. It's kind of like, it's sort of witty. So it's kind of like the Little Rascals meets Frasier. That's kind of how I think of it. But anyway, we're going to air that in the next bit. After that, Frank Pavone in an hour or two, David Barton, and lots of jokes. We'll be right back. She's a friend of mine. Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. We'll be right back.
now, Yankee Doodle Muggsy, read by me, the author, Eric Metaxas. And the book is by Eric Metaxas and Tim Raglan, and it's dedicated to the children of the American Revolution, past, present, and future. Oh, listen, my children, and you shall hear of the 4th of July and old Muggsy, dear. A greater patriot could ne'er be found, and hardly a man is now around who doesn't remember that famous day and cheer. On that hallowed day of our nation's birth, Muggsy, our hero, once more proved his worth as protector of Margaret, his beloved new wife, and Emily and Habakkuk in their happy new life. The morning began with a children's game. I was there as a witness, and the truth I proclaim, and just for the record, Peeves is my name. The stairs now he mounts. Hush, the children still sleep. Their door we approach, and inside now creep.
Oh, I'm your Yankee Doodle Muggsy. Your Uncle Muggsy, do or die. You're my niece and nephew. I your uncle am. And today is the 4th of July. Today's a Yankee Doodle's daydream. A day when flags and rockets fly. Uncle Muggsy went to London, called King George a phony. I am that Muggsy Doodle guy.
Then down the hall of history, they marked our freedom's trail as Muggsy named the noble names George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Nathan Hale, and told how as one the framers answered liberty's sweet call by making their great declaration at Independence Hall. And he told how Betsy Ross in haste the stars and stripes unfurled, and how Lexington and Concord was the shot heard round the world. Then he told of the winter of the troops who camped at Valley Forge, and how their stoic sacrifice in Pennsylvania's snow and ice defeated old King George.
Yankee Doodle Dandies, let's make a joyful noise and sing. We're the star-spangled children of our Uncle Sam, and today make the freedom bell ring. Let's cut a Yankee Doodle caper. Salute our founding fatherhood. Let's recite some happy birthday poetry to the land of the free and the good.
But in the midst of their festive song, the downstairs doorbell chimed. And so they left off their fifing and drumming. The British, they giggled, are coming, they're coming. One if by lap, two if by knee, and I'll dust the banister, Muggsy cried, wee! And so down the handrail a-flying they came and made such a scene in the hall. At the bottom they discharged as though from a gun, with Muggsy a great cannonball. Poor Muggsy, in crashing, had smashed all to bits some luggage there piled all around. He'd assaulted the ramparts of civilized taste in a single opening bound. And then from that wreckage he looked up to see that English Medusa, that Gorgon, that ghoul. It was Margaret's mother. She had come unannounced. A one-woman finishing school. Egad! And there she glowered jowlishly, so prim and grimly proper. Her teaching the children to fall again was a cold conversation stopper. That's not it at all, groaned Muggsy. You see, I was teaching the twins of our history. I see what you're teaching them, Ambrose, she snipped. Muggsy winced at that name painfully. In England, she went on, when Victoria was queen, we'd have music, then riding, then tea. But great Aunt Hortensia, the children now piped, today is the 4th of July. The parade starts at 4, Muggsy said, and what's more, the colors of freedom will fly. What nonsense, she sniffed, and declared in summation, the 4th of July is merely a day for proper education. And true to her word, without thought for the day, she commenced her campaign in the British way. While the twins were put through their proper paces, their thoughts could be seen on their sad little faces. They'd miss the parade and the fireworks, too. Would their dear Uncle Muggsy somehow come through? Might he yet save them from this hopeless to-do? Who knew? And what could he do? As promised, first music, and Hortensia would sing. Habakkuk's new violin popped a string. The tick of the metronome crisply kept time as the two of them sawed on and on. What a crime! I'll free you, thought Muggsy. Just give me some time. Equestrian training was next on the list. Emily's pony jumped first and missed. They trotted and cantered and hobbled and hopped. Hortensia's enthusiasm never stopped. But most painful of all was the deep crimson hue of their traditional horsey attire. Red coats on the fourth, this is war! Muggsy cried with patriotic fire. And by far the worst insult to that sacred day meant to honor the brave and the free was that starting at four with Hortensia's friends, they would suffer an English high tea. By Gadfrey, said Muggsy, I'll save them, I will, with some red, white, and blue rocketry. I'll remind them of all of our battles of yore. I'll show them once more who it was won that war on this day of our great liberty. And soon he'd return with a wheelbarrow full of crackers and candles and bombs. A true Bunker Hill of explosives it was, a gunpowder mountain of arms. He arranged them like minutemen ready to fight. He stood them behind rocks and trees. There were serpents and spinners and sparklers and snaps. There were mortars and missiles and whistles and caps. It would bring the redcoats to their knees. Whiz, bang, crack, boom! The battle at last had begun. The chit-chat now ended, the sipping now ceased. The ladies were blasted clean out of their seats, and the twins were at last having fun. I say, I can't see, old Hortensia declared, amidst the bombs bursting bright and the rockets' red glare. We are routed, dear ladies. Abandon the field. Lady Daphne fainted. Virginia reeled. Across the land, the Liberty Bell pealed. The battle was won. The day was now done. I had hoped we might cease and desist, but it wasn't to be, for now giddy with glee, true to form, Muggsy couldn't resist. For there yet was one rocket of red, white, and blue. They called it Big Martha for Washington's bride. The match now he struck, the fuse now he lit, but the missile took off with dear Muggsy astride. How high o'er the treetops like Lindbergh he flew. The world grew more distant as farther he zoomed. And Margaret, Hortensia, the children, and I all knew in our hearts that poor Muggsy was doomed. Shades of Icarus, barked Muggsy, a turn for the hearse. Victory wasn't supposed to be this hard. It puts me in mind of that line from the bard. I've been hoist by my own petard. Drat. But fortune besmiled upon Muggsy that day. The bomb, though it flew, was a miserable dud. It fell and it fell through the clouds to the ground, then fizzled and crashed in some mud. And when the smoke cleared, how Muggsy rejoiced. His life had been spared and the day was yet young. And to top it all off, he'd been given a mule. And now to his mane Muggsy clung. Onward, Bucephalus, onward, he cried. We'll catch that parade by the tail if we must. The Republic depends on us, so do the twins. Hi-ho, Yankee Doodle, or bust. Now swiftly he galloped and spread the good cheer to every village and farm far and near. Awaken, ye citizens, hearken and hear. America's birthday is here, America's birthday is here. All solemn and grave sat Margaret the twins and Hortensia too. They'd come out to see, but for sadness saw not. It was what Muggsy would have wanted to do. But lo, in the distance came a cry and a hue. 'Twas a mule hasting toward us in red, white, and blue. And atop that old mule, flying fearless and fleet, atop that swift steed racing down our main street, sat a fanciful fop, quite familiar somehow. And happy birthday, America, was writ upon his brow. Then the mule, he stopped short, and the rider was thrown. Muggsy landed and made his identity known. He lay battered and blackened with many a wound. A ghost, cried Hortensia, and swooned. You've come back, they all shouted. Hurrah, you're alive. Of course, Muggsy laughed. I'm just sore from the ride. Then each twin took an arm and helped him to stand. He lifted Old Glory and gave the command. Let's join the parade, Muggsy cried. Fall in line. The fife pierced the air and the drum marked the time. And the air and the afternoon swelled with their song. It rose to the heavens till marching along was another parade filled with heroes of yore. We've seen some of them in our story before, but others we haven't, whose song now we sing, and to them humbly make this our small offering. Yankee Doodle to all, and to all a good night.
Hey folks, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that special July 4th reading I did of Yankee Doodle Muggsy. We now have to turn to something a little bit more serious. I have someone I have admired for a long time as my guest for the rest of this hour, Father Frank Pavone, who heads up Priests for Life. Father Frank Pavone, welcome. It's just a joy to see you.
Well, Eric, the admiration is mutual. Thank you for all the great work that you do, and it is a real joy to be with you today.
Well, thank you. Now, I wanted you to help us process what we heard yesterday with regard to the Supreme Court's ruling. Many people know that Justice Roberts, the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, has tended to vote with the liberal wing, so-called. I think of them as the anti-constitutional legislate from the bench wing, actually, not the liberal.
Yes.
But what happened yesterday? What was the ruling that the court handed down yesterday? And what are those of us who are pro-life to make of it?
This was a ruling, Eric, as you know, about a law out of Louisiana. The Unsafe Abortion Protection Act. I mean, just from that name, you got to say, well, that makes a lot of sense. We want to protect women from unsafe abortion. It wasn't a ruling about the legality of abortion overall, but rather one of many rulings the Supreme Court has handed down now since Roe v. Wade, talking about how far can the state go in regulating abortion, granting that it's legal. How far can we go in regulating it? And one of the main reasons we want to regulate it, and that Louisiana did regulate it, is for the health and safety and protection of the mothers who go to these abortion facilities to get the procedure. Basically, in a nutshell, the court said Louisiana law went too far because it would make it too difficult for women to get an abortion in that state. Well, what was the law saying? The law was saying that the same rules that apply to all the other ambulatory surgical centers in the state, including that the doctors have to have admitting privileges at hospitals within 30 miles, need to apply to the abortion facilities. The abortion facilities were the only ones that did not have that requirement. And so the state was just saying, look, we want to bring them on par. If people are going to claim abortion is, you know, medicine, which we in and of itself we dispute, but that's another question. But if people want to claim that it's healthcare, well, then live up to the standards of healthcare. So the Louisiana legislature said, look, here's what we need to protect the women in our state, because we know there's a track record in Louisiana of very shoddy, dangerous practices by the abortionists there. It's a record clear to be seen for decades now. We've known this. And the Supreme Court unfortunately said, look, you know, if a law is going to deprive or going to make it difficult for even just some women to get the abortion, that law is unconstitutional, even if it's trying to protect their health. It's absurd and it's outrageous.
Well, let me ask you this again, you know, just to be clear, this is very basic stuff. Just as you outlined, you know, people are simply saying we need to hold the abortion industry accountable. They want to pretend that this is healthcare. Well, then we're going to call them on that, and we're going to ask them to do what everyone else does who is in healthcare in this state. They say, no, we don't want to do it. It's going to make it impossible for women to get abortions. And how is it that John Roberts, who's the swing vote, evidently, that he sides with this? Because as far as I can tell, there was a ruling about 4 years ago where he was on the other side of it. Is that right?
Yes. You know, this is very interesting because, first of all, looking at this on the political angle, it is unfortunate. You know, John Roberts has become the new Kennedy on the court. You know, he's gonna be the swing vote because the court is basically divided with four, as you say, and I would agree, anti-constitutional judges in the sense that they exceed their authority. And then four pretty strong constitutional justices. And then we've got Roberts in the middle. Fortunately, we should say, the two appointees of President Trump, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, ruled the right way in this decision. And, of course, that was very, very gratifying.
And Alito and Thomas.
I was referring to Gorsuch and Kavanaugh.
No, but I'm saying, but also Alito.
Also and Alito and Thomas. Yeah, absolutely.
The minority of four.
And as you know, this decision was penned by Breyer. Now Breyer and Ginsburg are the two oldest members of the court, 82 and 87, respectively. So again, this highlights the importance of the elections. I mean, if President Trump can be the one to name the successors of Breyer and Ginsburg, should that come to pass, that would certainly be in our favor in cases like this. What Chief Justice Roberts did in this decision was that he was relying on what we would say is an exaggerated misapplication of this principle of stare decisis. In other words, that if the court has ruled a certain way in the past, this establishes a precedent, and subsequent decisions should, if not be absolutely governed by that, at least let that precedent carry a lot of weight. Stare decisis, keep things on the same track. Now, the fact of the matter is that the court overrules its own decisions many, many times in our history.
Actually, this is a very important point. We're going to go to break. When we come back, I will let you clarify that. It is just... it is so strange, but it's important that we understand it. We'll be right back with Father Frank Pavone. It's here from Texas Show. I'm talking to someone I've admired for a long time, Father Frank Pavone, with Priests for Life. And we're trying to make sense of yesterday's Supreme Court decision where Justice Roberts sided with what we call the liberal wing. And you were saying, Father Pavone, that stare decisis was what seems to have tipped him. In other words, he says that there is a precedent whenever the court rules, we've got to go with that. But isn't it ironic that he was on the other side when that ruling came down? He dissented in that ruling 4 years ago, but now he's saying because of stare decisis, even though I agreed legally with it, now stare decisis seems to take precedent over what I was thinking legally 4 years ago, or am I exaggerating?
No, you know, stare decisis is a prudential judgment when you come right down to it. The court, in evaluating a case, needs to make the judgment at that point whether and to what extent a previous case applies. And in fact, there's an excellent book that you may be familiar with that actually Justice Gorsuch and Kavanaugh are co-authors of before they ended up seated on the Supreme Court. It's called The Law of Judicial Precedent. And this book goes through the various reasons why the court would and should overturn even long-standing precedent. Here we're talking about a decision that was issued 4 years ago on a very similar law that was passed in Texas that said, okay, the abortionists have to have hospital admitting privileges within 30 miles. Okay, what happened in Texas is that the court said, well, you know, this has had an impact. It has had an impact. It's been in effect, and we've seen that it has reduced the availability of abortion across the state. And the reason for that, Eric, of course, should send up a red flag in people's minds. If abortion facilities have to close or abortionists have to quit because they can't live up to a health and safety standard, why would you want them in there in the first place, right? But in Texas, it had that effect. And the Supreme Court said, well, we can't make it so burdensome for women to get an abortion. We're going to have to strike down this law. That was the, quote, precedent that Roberts was now relying on. But it was, as you said, it was only 4 years ago. You know, this is not some kind of solid.
But not only that, but he legally dissented from that ruling 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's bizarre to me that it strikes me as at least looking disingenuous on his part.
Yeah. And also, there's another issue that was at stake here. And this really, again, to common sense is offensive. The abortionists were the ones challenging the law. Not a single woman in Louisiana came forward and said, this law is harming me or my rights. Now, usually that's what a court case is about, right? Somebody goes into court and says, hey, my rights are being damaged by this policy or this law or whatever. And the parties, you know, dispute about that. In this case, it was the abortionists. Now, here they are coming into court claiming to represent the women who come to them for abortions, but the law was meant to protect those very women from those very abortionists. So why in the world should they be able to speak on behalf of those women whom the law is trying to protect from their malpractice and from their shoddy procedures? So it's a question of third party standing, which sometimes the court grants. You think of a child, for example, being represented by his or her parents. That's quite legitimate. That the child can't, you know, undertake the role of representing himself or herself in the courts. The parent, who has a close relationship with the child, it makes sense that they would stand in for him or her. But in this case, there is no close relationship. The abortionist and the woman coming for an abortion are total strangers. And not only that, there's a conflict of interest because these abortionists do have a clear track record of dangerous and shoddy practices. And I mean, we're talking about not monitoring vital signs, using expired medication, not having emergency medical equipment, having untrained staff do procedures, sending the woman home while she's still bleeding, leaving parts of the baby inside of her. One of the Louisiana cases that the woman went home after the abortion and the baby's head was still inside her body. I mean, these are the kind of things that the Louisiana legislators are trying to say, listen, we've got to increase the standards by which these doctors are permitted to do this procedure. And so therefore, it doesn't make sense that the abortionists themselves, who are the ones being regulated, should be able to stand in court for unnamed women that haven't even come forth yet to complain about this law.
Well, Father Pavone, also, you know, we remember, of course, when Bill Clinton famously said that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. Now, that's the issue here, is that they're playing games, because if you want it to be safe, you would advocate for the highest possible medical standards. But because profit is involved, it becomes clear to disinterested observers that the abortion industry is much more interested in profits than in the women that are paying the money. There's no doubt about that. And the fact that the abortion industry and advocates of abortion in America constantly pretend to care about the women. And in a case like this, you say, well, if you care about the women, what could your possible objection be to raising the medical standards, raising the safety standards? And they say, well, we just can't do enough of them. We want to do more of them. We want to make money under shoddy circumstances in unsafe conditions. It is an extraordinary thing to me. I guess I'm most shocked that Justice Roberts turned a blind eye to this, or worse.
It is really sad. And you know, Eric, you mentioned about the women. The oral arguments in this particular case were held at the beginning of March. And we were there. We submitted one of the many friend of the court briefs in this particular case. In fact, there were more pro-life briefs submitted in this case than any previous case. It was amazing. And including 207 members of Congress signed on to an amicus brief. 80 of the state legislators of Louisiana signed on to another brief, medical experts, and so many other people. What we, and other states too, by the way, weighed in on this and said, yes, we support Louisiana because we want to have the same kind of health and safety standards in our states. But what we did was our brief, and together with a number of the others, represented the voices of the women who've had abortions.
Father Pavone, hang on. We're going to a hard break. I want to hear about that, about the amicus brief when we come back. Folks, don't go away. Hey folks, talking to Father Frank Pavone of Priest for Life. You can go to the website endabortion.us. That's endabortion.us. Father Pavone, you're talking about the amicus brief that you and Priest for Life filed in this case that the Supreme Court just yesterday ruled on. And you said that you were in that specifically speaking for the women.
Yes, we have under the umbrella of Priest for Life, the Rachel's Vineyard, which is the largest ministry for healing after abortion in the world. And we also have the Silent No More campaign, as you know, the women who've had abortions, and also the dads that have been involved and other family members, speaking out about that experience. So the day of the oral arguments, as well as the day before, we were there in front of the Supreme Court having rallies, and one after another of these women got up and publicly shared their abortion experience, how badly they were treated by the abortionist, how the abortionist was a complete stranger and didn't have their best interests in heart, how they not only mistreated them, but physically injured them, the shoddy experience they had in the abortion facilities. We had women from Louisiana that had abortions at some of the very places that were petitioning the court in this particular case. We know the voices of the women in this debate, and really, I want to encourage our listeners and viewers, use their testimonies. These women come forward, not just when there's a case like this, but all throughout the year, to tell the rest of the world what it's like when you really actually do have an abortion, and it's not a pretty picture. Their testimonies are at another website, abortiontestimonies.com, and people can read about their experiences or watch them give these stirring witnesses, and this is a voice that at least it's gotten into the record of the court. And this isn't the first case. There have been multiple cases where we've been able to get the testimonies of these women into the court record, and we've been told it is a very important part of the way that these cases can end up being decided.
Well, I mean, many times I've spoken about the life of William Wilberforce and the campaign to end the slave trade in the British Empire. And that story in my book has reminded so many people of what the pro-life movement is up against right now. And I guess looking back to Wilberforce, when I think of how many times they lost over and over again, they would just pile up the testimonies that people would come in and tell first-person accounts of the horrors of what the conditions were like on these slave ships and on and on and on. Eventually, they succeeded. And I really do believe that you and other brave voices who have been so consistent that we're chipping away, and that your average American, once they know, once they hear what is really happening, what the women are really experiencing, not what the profiteers want to tell them. I think people's minds slowly, Father Frank, are being changed. When you hear about the science, you know, 50 years ago, it was a clump of cells. Now we've got all this imaging and stuff. You can't pretend that it's a clump of cells. I really do believe that the facts and science are on the side of life, and that in time, by God's grace, we will see some reversals of these cases.
No doubt. People should not be discouraged by the outcome of this case. They should be concerned, but it should impel them to work even harder in the pro-life cause. And I'm grateful for all our listeners and viewers that do. This was a narrow decision. This was 5-4. And again, in the next few years, you know, we're going to be seeing more Supreme Court replacements. Let's make sure that goes away.
And this is another reason, you know, to vote for Donald Trump. You might hate him.
Exactly.
But I think you understand what's at stake, folks. The other side is not exactly friendly to the unborn. Father Frank Pavone, thank you so much. Folks,
Great to be with you.
Thank you. I want my audience to go to endabortion.us, endabortion.us. And thanks for listening, folks.